Welcome to Manager Tools. Case Study Interviews, Part 1. Here we go. Today's cast answers these questions. What is a case study interview? What kinds of questions are there in case study interviews? How can I prepare for a case study interview? Well, if you want answers to these questions and more, keep listening.
Hey, did you know we'll be visiting Shanghai, China in a few months? We're not able to visit often, so if you're interested in joining us, this is your perfect opportunity. On November 6th and 7th, we'll be at the Intercontinental Shanghai Hotel in Pudong New Area with our effective manager and effective interviewer conferences. Register today at manager-tools.com/training. We hope to meet you there.
Today, we're going to talk about the question that often comes up on interviews, which is, you're 5 inches tall and you're the size of a nickel and you're at the bottom of a blender. What do you do?
Yeah, that's a particularly bizarre.
Yeah,
question. You're referring to one type of case study interview questions, which most people don't realize, the estimation questions or the math questions that we'll talk about are actually part and parcel of the larger idea of case study interviews. That one about the blender and being able to jump out and so on, I find just bizarre. But many people will learn on this cast that the rest of those estimation questions, we'll walk through one today, are not bizarre. They're absolutely normal. And in fact, case study interviews are just a specific form of behavioral interviews. That's all they are.
Yeah, and people wouldn't listen to Manager Tools if you just thought of managers as Dilbert, right? So there are ridiculous case study interview questions. And then there are those that make absolute sense. And after this cast, people will understand why that is true.
Yeah. So look, we got three parts of this cast. For those of you who listen in order, which I think is very rare unless you've just started with us, this is coming right on the heels of our inaugural Manager Tools case study, which I think was four parts. The last part was 2 hours long. And we had our friend Dan McGuire on, who told us a story about a guy named Dean Morgan at a company called Webcom. And I'll just give you a spoiler alert, folks. You may want to fast forward 30 seconds to avoid hearing that Dean Morgan was Dan McGuire. And he told us what he did in the situation. And we appreciate all those of you who wrote in your what you would do when we said, okay, you're the CEO of this company. What are you going to do in your first week on the job? We got a lot of hard work. People listen to that cast 5 or 6 times. And we thought we would just continue and do case study interviews since they're related in the business world, generally speaking. This cast has three parts. What a case study interview is. And then we're going to talk about the two types of case study interviews, which are quantitative assessments and situational case assessments. Pretty straightforward stuff, but there's a lot to cover. And we have to start with a caveat. We cannot, in this cast, and perhaps even in many more, teach you how to succeed in all case interviews, particularly the situational cases. It takes hours and hours of preparation to master the kinds of case interviews a top management consulting firm would put to a job candidate. We can't teach you, even in a few casts, how to master a case that involves foreign profit margins, strategic decisions about capital investment, return on invested capital, LIFO, LIFO, last in, first out accounting. But you ought to know about this part of the professional world, particularly if you're thinking about getting an MBA. If you're thinking about getting an MBA, when you go to your MBA school, you'll probably be taught, in at least in some of your classes, using the case method. And it's good to know what you're getting into. And I find them fascinating, and we'll talk more about that later. Case study interviews are used most often by strategy and management consulting firms to evaluate the business skills of folks, candidates, for positions as consulting associates at their firms. It's the standard way. And as we'll talk later, it's a behavioral interview. Some larger companies, generally big multinationals, use them to evaluate candidates for special positions in strategic roles, strategy, mergers and acquisitions, those kinds of things. And those roles generally require familiarity with complex financial and predictive models that generally are limited to large, again, multinational firms. The concept of a case study interview attempts to approximate the complexity of the client problems and the ability of a candidate to address those problems. Now, obviously, if you've got 4 weeks to do something for a client, an interview that only lasts 2 hours is by definition an approximation. And since I mentioned approximation, then we can say proxy. But most people who have been through this process will tell you it is a very good process for you to determine whether or not you like it and also whether or not you're good at it.
Yeah, my daughter was, I was helping her with some geometry homework the other night. And one of their questions, she was asked to write down all her work. So there was some algebra. Now she's 15, so she's not doing really complex stuff. And she had to transform this equation. There's probably 7 or 8 steps she had to, you know, take the square root of both sides, square, you know, that kind of stuff. And so the instructor was interested, obviously, in the answer. But what they wanted to see was, what was her thinking process? How did she go through it? And so I think of case study interviews as similar to that. It's not necessarily the answer that's what they want to get to. They want to understand your thinking process and how you get there, because they know that the questions they're going to throw at you if they should hire you for clients are going to be complex and different. And there's no way they could ask you a question that would cover every single case that they might throw at you with a client. So they want to know how you think. How do you work through problems?
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard from many people is there are two primary criteria. There's some sub-criteria in case interviews. One is the process you use to get to the recommendation you make about, you know, should we sell this division, for instance, is a classic case problem. And they give you all kinds of charts and graphs. And at the end of the case, where you're essentially making statements and asking questions and learning more data throughout it, you have to say yes or no. And then you have to support your recommendation. And you're supposed to follow a process. And then the other thing that they're going to evaluate is the recommendation. Do they agree with it? In fact, it's probably a historical case and they made one or the other. So it would be good, obviously, if yours matched that. But what everyone will tell you is it is much more the process. If you have a great process, but miss a number, even by an order of magnitude, doing some multiplication or some chart transformations or whatever, and your process is right, but you get the recommendation wrong, you can be okay. If you get the right answer, but your process isn't something that would inspire confidence because
repeatable.
Yeah. Here's a key part. A client of a consulting firm will not implement a right answer or recommendation that they can't understand. You have to be able to communicate why you got to where you got. And if the process is clear and logical, it may in fact have some insights. Insights are great. But if the process is clear and logical, it wouldn't matter if you had the perfect answer, but it didn't make sense to the client because they're not going to do it.
Yeah, you got to persuade them.
Yeah, the process is a form of the persuasion.
Yeah, it's like relationships. And my boss telling me, Mike, you're right 99.99% of the time, but if the client doesn't like you, they're not going to accept it. It's like, relationships. Yeah. Wow, darn it.
Okay, so I alluded to candidates facing these kind of interviews are typically business school students, and they're interviewing with companies who come to their school to recruit. It's not always that way, but it's typically that way. And for those of you who don't know, it's the strength of the companies that come to recruit that provide much of the value associated with MBA programs, at least in the U.S. and I know in Europe as well. Now, usually, this means MBA students, but there are some undergraduate programs who teach using the case method. Once business schools started using cases to teach management many years ago, the firms that recruited there, consulting firms, finance firms, large multinationals, started using case study interviews. And interestingly, just so you're clear, we'll use different words just because they sound good in a particular sentence. But what schools do is actually called the case method. If you're at law school, they use a similar technique where you have to explicate a case. They call that the casebook method or casebook method. So schools use the case method versus actually case studies. They give you a case to study. And so you hear people say case study, but the technical term for it is a case method where you're analyzing a case. And then schools use the case method and companies that recruit there do case interviews. Now, here's something interesting, and it goes to the whole thing of the estimation question, the blender one, or the how many barbers are there or whatever. Case interviews are not solely about full hypothetical cases. If you hear one of those questions and it's for a regular job at a regular company, it's very unlikely to be a useful outcome for the recruiter, for the hiring manager. We'll explain that. But there are basically two types of interview questions or formats at a high level that are called case interviews. The first part is basically quantitative assessments. The second part is what you would think is called a case interview, which are the hypothetical cases. So we're going to start, and I think probably all we'll do, Mike, I don't know, but I think all we'll do in this cast is get through the first part, which is quantitative assessments. And then we'll go through some hypothetical case. We won't go through some. I was about to say some because that would take days. But we hope to continue this and help people learn about how one approaches a case so that if you're ever at work and a case comes up where you're supposed to look at it and analyze it and so on, you'll at least have a place to start. Okay, so there are two types, broadly, of quantitative assessments in use as part of case interviews today. The first is the estimation question, which we alluded to, and the other is a quantitative test. Estimation questions are problems designed to show your ability to solve mildly complicated math problems relatively quickly using some assumptions and some estimates and some rules of thumb without the benefit of research or a calculator. You basically have nothing but a pen and paper in the interview to do your calculations.
Yeah. The math's pretty easy, but getting to the math is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm really curious as to how people are going to react to this, because as we were preparing for this cast and you start going through it, you go like, eh, some people would just absolutely hate to have to go through this, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I have to tell you, I've been in plenty of discussions with other consultants at a firm or business folks. It's just, okay, is that number 240 million or 265? And the consultants look at each other and goes, it doesn't matter. No, they really, you know, the guy says, oh, we really need the right answer. No, we don't. The only question is it more than 75 million or is it less than 400 million? And yeah, it is. That's the only question we're analyzing here. There's a threshold and that's all that matters. This clearly makes it. Even if our math is off by $20 million, 10%, it doesn't matter. Typically, an estimation question happens early in the process of interviewing. And if you can't show yourself to be handy with these estimation questions, you won't get a full case to work through. So here are a few examples. Guys, you can go online and find hundreds more. I've probably looked at about 100 getting ready for this cast. And probably 25% of them I wouldn't consider questions that you would actually get in an interview. I think somebody made them up and they sound like good estimation questions, but we'll talk more about the rationale for estimation questions here shortly. So, how many barbers are there in the greater Atlanta, Georgia area? How many golf balls will fit inside a 747 aircraft?
Important question.
Yeah. Hey, well, what if you lose a lot of balls and you need a fresh shipment? And what is the monthly profit of a restaurant you yourself frequent? Now, let's talk about these, and people are shaking their head going, really? Somebody would ask me that? The answer to that question is probably not, unless you're interviewing for a job where these kinds of questions might be in. The answers to these kind of questions might be instructive to the hiring manager. Now, if you're interviewing to be an operations manager in a plant that produces fixtures And you get this question in an interview. I would argue that's not a good use of the question. But part of that is because it happens. It happens outside of effective use. So when questions like these surface in popular news, somebody tells somebody, and they, you're not going to believe it. I got this question. What do I do? And people Google it to find out if there's a right answer. And they're like, I didn't know. Right. I just told the guy I didn't know. There's some amazement, some sense of amazement that this kind of question even exists. Like, seriously? I mean, what? Anyway.
Right. But they'll be similar, right? There'll be similar types of questions. For example, golf balls in a 747, that sounds kind of crazy, unless you're involved in some kind of, interviewing for some kind of logistical job, right? I mean, in context, they can make a lot of sense.
Yeah, but really the purpose of the question is not about golf balls or aircrafts or fuselage or anything else. That's not, in other words, if you were interviewing for a government position that regulated professions in Georgia, the question about how many barbers there are in the greater Atlanta area is not a good question. The relationship between the topic being addressed and the type of job you're doing is really not important. It's not the topic that matters. It is the fact that you may be put in situations where you would have to do this kind of stuff. So they're really not silly for certain types of roles. The reason these questions are asked for consulting interviews is because clients ask consultants these kinds of questions all the time. Hey, look, we have to figure out whether or not this division can make $100 million in profit in the next 3 years. We already know three other divisions can. We don't have enough capital to invest in four. If this one can, then it needs to be in consideration for the horse race to decide where we're going to invest and where we're going to cut costs. So I need a simple answer to whether or not it can do that. And that's not only could be a case, but it also is a form of estimation. And the consultant goes through a process in order to determine roughly whether or not it can. If it says, the best we could do is $20 million, there's probably no amount of math that would get you to $100 million. On the other hand, if your math says $200 million, okay, it's probably worth the time in the next 3 weeks to really drill down and to find out how much above the $100 million it could make. Look, if the client is trying to figure out whether to offer cash buyouts based on years of service in the event of a layoff, or offer outplacement plus early retirement benefits, you could spend weeks figuring out the exact amount of each of those things. It would take a while, for instance, if you wanted to boil the ocean, to apply formulas across hundreds of roles, the categories of which are driven by different compensation models and assumptions, and then do two different analyses and see what the math is, what the cost is to the company. And it may be necessary to do that. And it probably will be done, although it had probably been done by analysts and specialists with access to the data internal to the company with some guidance from you rather than from a lead consultant. But you could probably do some simple estimation relatively quickly to determine whether the difference between the two possibilities is minor or is an order of magnitude apart. And so we don't need to do the work. And those people could be doing other work because there's a time crunch and we don't have an unlimited supply of the labor we need to make some of these decisions. Now, the final decision, the actual recommendation, probably won't be made without a detailed analysis. But if we know there's an order of magnitude between the two, or $50 million, well, the cost is going to be $10 million or $30 million based on estimation. You're probably going to choose the $10 million and you're going to go through the rigorous process and have a bunch of math. If you don't have enough analysts to both the $10 million analysis and the $30 million analysis, you better do the analysis on the one you recommend. And so again, the analysis may still get done and that may take weeks, but that analysis is end up going to be guided by a basic understanding about the estimated difference between the options. Now, as I alluded to a little bit before, if this kind of approximation and problem-solving approach aren't germane to the role you're interviewing for, it's a wasted question. In many cases we're aware of, guys, it's probably grandstanding on the part of the interviewer, okay? It probably is an effort at stressing the candidate, which you guys probably know this, our experience shows isn't terribly valuable in determining someone's suitability for most roles. Additionally, the interviewer who explains the right answer, who takes the time to say, well, let me explain how this works, and they want to show you what the right answer is, and it's usually some fantabulous number or an interesting something that you hadn't thought of. I think in the example of the blender one, they say, oh, you don't have to worry about the blender being turned on if you're only as high as a quarter. You'd be able to jump out. Yeah, okay. Somebody who explains the right answer, as if the answer is important, shows by doing that they don't get the purpose of the question. The purpose of an estimation question is not to get the right answer, but to show the interviewer how you answer such a question, again, versus the accuracy. So I've said this probably, Mike, to, 100 people, and almost nobody gets it. For some reason, particularly those people who haven't faced these questions or don't understand case interviewing, they get fixated on, you know, am I supposed to know the answer to that? Or am I supposed to know every single parameter and dimension that goes into that? And you tell them, no. You don't need that. It'll be fine. And then they get irritated because there's already fear and uncertainty and usually some loathing with interviewing in general. So what we thought we'd do is take you through an example of one. I chose the golf ball question. Why wouldn't I? So how many golf balls will fit inside a 747 aircraft? Guys, I'm going to say again, you don't have to get the right answer. And what happens for many people is they don't know well enough the two dimensions of the golf ball and the aircraft. And so they basically are panicking because they fail to realize that it's the process you go through and the inevitable estimations somebody would have to make. Because, of course, guys, no one expects you to know the size of these things. By the way, a golf ball is 1.68 inches. But again, the interviewer doesn't expect you to know that. And even if you did, the interviewer is going to assume you don't know other parameters like the capacity of the 747. So while having the exact amount for the golf ball reduces your potential for error, estimated the golf ball slightly too high or too low may very well be overcome by your estimation of the aircraft dimensions. So if you're thinking there, you should be able to get a right answer for this, by definition, in common parlance, you can't know every dimension of everything that they could ask you about. So it's inevitable that it must be about your process and not about the answer.
So I shouldn't worry about it. My estimation of the size of a golf ball would have been 2 inches.
That would be fine.
And explains why I always top the ball, because I'm thinking actually the ball is bigger than it is. So I always, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that would. I should just be quiet and let you talk about that, you hitting the golf ball. And again, everything you're going to do in this example is an estimation question. And if you think about it for a second, if you're going to do some estimations and some math, you know, some division, some multiplication, some, you know, squares, which is multiplication basically, and you're going to have to use pi and so on, and you're probably talking about a fairly big number. It's not 1,000 golf balls, right? By the way, it's funny. I've actually had somebody tell me that their first answer to the question is how many golf balls. It was a similar one. It may have been ping pong balls. It was something else. It was how many of these small things fit into this big space. The guy said, well, at least one. And then he said, and now let me take you through the process. And the interviewer thought it was funny. But look, if you were to choose 1.68 because you in fact knew that was the diameter of a golf ball, that probably makes your job harder. And you would be expected to know that. Because now the math you have to do is not with a number like 1.6 or 1.5, although Mike's is even easier at 2, but now you're doing math with 1.68. You've made every calculation you have to do a little harder with that extra decimal point. Now, you're not going to lose any credit on your answer for estimating at 1.6, even if you did know the actual diameter, because again, it's not expected that you know it.
Yeah, and be smart, round it to 1.6 or 1.5. Yeah.
And actually, I don't remember anybody ever telling me they rounded it to 2, Mike. The thing about the diameter is the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed, right?
Right.
If you choose a diameter of the golf ball of 2 inches, now your number is 1. Your radius. You cube 1 and you get 1. It's very exciting. Estimation-wise. But I've never heard anybody do that. So look, you should be able to calculate the volume of a sphere. Guys, now this is where somebody said, well, I never remember getting taught that. Yeah, you know, if you're a secondary school graduate, a high school graduate, you got taught at some point in geometry. That's 4/3 pi r cubed. Let me put it this way. It's a reasonable assumption that an educated person knows that formula. But if you're trying to get a perfect answer, right? Think about this. The volume of each golf ball doesn't perfectly represent the volume it takes up in the airframe because round balls have space between them when they are together, right? They don't sit perfectly. There's a lot of space in between them. You might, in fact, choose to use the volume of a cube with the space between the balls being accounted for by the larger calculation of the diameter of the ball cubed. Not that that's exact either, but you wouldn't inherently be dinged for that. Then we have your estimation of the volume of the airframe. You could choose to consider the airframe completely empty and model it as a pure cylinder. Even if you didn't remember that, you don't remember what the volume is of a cylinder, you'd probably be expected to figure out that its volume is the area of a circle, the cross-section, times the length of the body, the length of the cylinder. So that's pi times radius squared times the length of the cylinder. But that estimate supposes, not that it's clearly stated, that you're using the whole airframe and that it's circular. You could assume that the question only refers to the passenger section. You could then make the assumption that the passenger cabin is created by halving the cylinder lengthwise, meaning that now your volume to fill with golf balls is half the total volume. And by the way, folks, I just have to make a plug here. If you're at all interested in aircraft or aircraft history, and by the way, the 747 was a hugely transformative aircraft for the airline industry worldwide. If you want to read an incredible story about the dimensions of the 747 figuring into its creation, read the first 20 pages of a book called Wide Body by Clive Irving. That story at the beginning, the engineer going to Pan Am headquarters in New York City to tell them what they were building and why they should buy it, is in my all-time favorite business stories. Okay, back to reality. Guys, we know that you don't know the length of a 747, and we don't expect you to. Consultants don't go around. Strategic decision makers don't go around in their head with all these dimensions, okay? Even if your golf ball dimension is precise, what if you're off on the length of the airframe by 100 feet? That creates a mistake in your answer of, say, 33%, the difference between 300 and 400 feet, okay? That's fairly significant. Even if you said the golf ball was, you know, 1 inch in diameter, that'd be roughly a mistake of 33%. But most people, by the way, when they do this, and I've asked this question before for a client, when they're trying to figure out what the golf ball is, they put their thumb and finger a certain distance apart because most people have held a golf ball in their hand. And they say, well, it's not 1 inch. That's too small. And it's not 2 inches. That's too big. So it's 1.5. That's what most people do. But then you got to ask yourself, what about the wings? They store fuel in the wings. And all he said was 747. He didn't say fuselage. Maybe we should include the wings. And then you start thinking, oh my gosh, what's the equation for the shape of a wing? Because there is one. But again, no, stop. Everything I just walked you through. The above follows the thinking of someone working towards a numerical answer. But this question, again, asked in the right context, not for just any old job, is not about your numerical answer. It's about your process. The question approximates business estimation questions that are routinely asked of consultants and certain specialists or roles. Remember, I said business estimation questions. In other words, the process of estimation, not can you please estimate how many miles of pipeline there are in the Middle East. We mentioned this before. They're often asked to help a client or decision maker reduce or eliminate the need for all the measurements, all the data gathering, et cetera, to get to a precise answer. The goal here is not precision, but effective parameter setting, estimation, and speed.
Before we let you go, don't forget to consider joining us in Shanghai this November 6th and 7th. We look forward to hosting you there.
Thanks, everyone. That's it for this week. We'll continue on with this cast next week. In the meantime, have a great one. So long.